Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. So anytime you hear this cute little slide guitar sound, you'll know there's a track to go along with it on the playlist. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964. Hey everybody and music nerds, happy new year. This is episode number 136 of the show. Oh yeah, I hope everyone had a safe and groovy little holiday. Thank you so much, all you listeners out there, for the messages and the Apple reviews that you sent my way the last couple weeks. That stuff really helps the cause. And lots of good ideas came in on future guests that you'd like to hear from, too, in upcoming seasons. I like that we're on the same wavelength here, people. So this is episode 136, and my guest today is an incredible singer and songwriter and performer, originally from the Bay Area, but now just lives a few blocks away from me here in Nashville, Nikki Bloom. So it's 2023. It's shaping up to be a pretty good year, I think. I have a bunch of sessions and production work coming up here in Nashville, which is nice. Not enough live gigs at this point for me, but hoping that'll change as we get going here. Sometimes it does. I will be touring with my band, though, in April, which ought to be fun. I'll keep you posted on those dates as we get closer to that. And there's a few annual things that I do now, and I'll be doing again this year. That includes a stint in Vancouver in the fall for a few shows. And the Hen House Hang recording camp will be held here in Nashville, September 25th through 28th, right after Americana Fest this year. There's a few spots left for that, so if you want to take part and learn some stuff about recording and come hang for a few days, it's going to be a blast. So you can get info on that whole thing over at stevedawson.ca. For anyone that missed the last episode, there are 5 more shows coming this season, including today's, and that'll be followed by a little break while I get Season 7 prepped. And then we'll be launching that sometime in the spring this year as well. And lastly, just a quick shout out to a couple of supporters this last couple of weeks who kicked in with one-time donations or Patreon subscription. Thank you so much. That is greatly appreciated. And I couldn't do it without you. They are Mike Fair and my old buddy Don Rook. He's from Toronto. He's a wicked lap steel player. He's got a band called The Henrys. You should all go and listen to The Henrys. Check them out. All right, so this week on the show, we have Nikki Bloom. I heard her recent record, Avondale Drive, about 6 months ago, and I was totally blown away by it and pleasantly surprised to find that she lived really close by. So Nikki swung by in between some tour dates, and we had a good old conversation that you'll be hearing in a minute. She's been out on tour with Little Feat recently. She sings backup and sings a couple songs with their live show, and I think she'll be doing that again in the spring. She's made a bunch of killer records on her own, and she's just got a really powerful and soulful voice that I dig. Her latest album, as I mentioned, is called Avondale Drive, and she's got another solo record called To Rise, You Gotta Fall, and then a few with her old band called The Gramblers, which is a band that she fronted with her ex-husband and Mother Hips member Tim Bloom. These days, she tours with a great band and sometimes as a duo with her new partner, Jesse Wilson, who she made this new album with during the pandemic. It was fun to hang and great to get to know her a little bit, and I think you'll enjoy getting to know her as well through this conversation right now. Just a reminder to check the accompanying Spotify playlist to hear a bunch of her music and some of the other music that we talk about on the show. And you can keep posted with Nikki all of her upcoming tour dates and new releases, if there are any, and all that stuff at nikkibloom.com. All right, let's get down to it. Enjoy my conversation with Nikki Bloom. So this was a COVID project for you, I guess.
It was, yeah, it was a COVID project. We actually started recording just out of sheer, like, boredom. You know, Jesse and I were talking. Jesse and I were living together at the time and still are, but he and I were...
This is Jesse Wilson,
yeah, correct? This is Jesse, okay. Noah Wilson. He and I were living together, and, you know, it was sort of just like this endless unknown of, like, when are we going to get in the studio? When are we going to get in the studio? And it was like, let's just start recording demos. He had kind of converted a bedroom area.
This is still pre-COVID?
This is, yes. No, this is 2020. This is, like, early 2020.
So when you hadn't started the process yet?
No,
but
no.
You had a group of songs?
Had, like, 20 songs and were basically kind of like, I was ready to record. You know, I had a delivery to Compass I needed to make, and I just was, like, ready to make it happen. And he's like, let's just start recording demos. He'd kind of, like, made a little home recording area in one of the bedrooms at the house, and we were just going to make demos so that when we could get into the studio, it was like we were ready to go. And we started making demos, and it was just kind of like, well, this is actually pretty cool. Like,
yeah.
This is cool. And then, you know, it'd be like, well, let's send this track to Richard Millsap, which is Jesse's brother-in-law. He was set up, you know, to play drums in L.A. And so we, like, floated the track to Richard, and he recorded drums and sent it back to us. And that's kind of when we just discovered this process of, like, remote recording, which we've all become incredibly familiar with now, post-COVID.
Yeah.
And that it actually works and it's pretty effective and pretty fun because, you know, you give this allowance to people you trust and, you know, you get back their interpretation of your song, which is really cool without a lot of, like, instruction, you know, which is nice. And
they have to be creatively minded going into it, too, because they don't necessarily hear very much at the time that they're working on the song, too, right?
Totally. Totally. You know, it could be maybe like acoustic and scratch vocal or something. So you're right. Yeah, they're definitely, it made it really fun and collaborative because they became really deeply part of the process. And, you know, it was just sort of one of those silver linings of the time because everybody was stuck at home and everybody was creatively starved and everybody was like isolated and wanting to collaborate and wanting to commune. And this was a way to do it safely. And nobody was touring. So it was like, you know, people who would typically be on the road, Oliver Wood, Carl Denson, Jay Belarus, Jen Conos, like these people who we would normally not be able to pin down were very accessible because nobody could tour.
And into it.
Yeah, these are all old friends of mine, old family friends of Jesse's. His family is like deep music family. And, you know, Jay Belarus is like his uncle. So
what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. His parents, Teresa James and Terry Wilson, they're like incredibly accomplished life musicians. And
that's his parents.
That's Jesse's parents. Yeah. So he sort of has all
these.
So
what's their relation?
In what way?
To Jay Belarus.
They're just old friends. Jay plays drums. Teresa James and the Rhythm Tramps are a great band out of L.A., and Jay plays drums with them when he can. Jen Condos and Teresa have a band called Queen Cake together in L.A. And yeah, just, you know, years and years of being in the music business and living in L.A.
Yeah, so Jay and Jen worked on records for me, too,
nice.
At the same time. So I know the I know the exact feeling of... So they were like a pretty formidable team, I think, except that Jen actually didn't like doing it. Like, she, now that it's over, she, I don't think she ever wants to see a microphone again in her life.
Yeah. I mean, but, I had to go to LA when they were still set up, and it was just really cool to see their setup, like that big, you know, outdoor patio umbrella in the middle of their living room with Jay's drums, you know,
they sent
under
me photos.
It. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And, you know, I guess Jay buys Jen a microphone every Christmas. So like their locker of mics is extensive and they could finally put it to use. And I think Jen just felt pressure of like, you know, she's not a recording engineer, but she had to become one. And she did a great job.
She did a great job.
She did an amazing job, you know.
But she was really self-deprecating about it and pretty insecure about her results, but they were amazing.
They're amazing.
Really. Yeah. And super vibey. And yeah, they weren't like a traditional thing at all, but Jay is not a traditional drummer, so
totally.
She has such a good handle on what he does, and they communicate well in the regards of like Jay can just communicate what his needs are for like a particular song, where he might be doing something particularly weird.
Totally.
She can figure out how to deal with that.
Totally. They have like a deep intimacy musically and obviously personally too, but I think that all translates and lends to both, you know, dynamics.
So Jen played bass on your record.
She did. Any track that Jay's on, Jen played bass on.
Okay. And when she does the bass, does she record it or does Jay jump over and take over the...
That's a good question. I'm kind of assuming she probably took the reins, but I don't want to, you know, take away credit from Jay, so...
Yeah. Although I can't picture him doing that, but I wondered if he flipped around and helped her out or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
For me, it was like a giant Christmas present most mornings where I'd wake up and there'd be a thing from Jay and Jen from some of them were like, I sent them some weird stuff. I was doing like an instrumental record at the time that was pretty spacey and weird. And he just went to town on that stuff. And it was like really layered and textured. And he had tons of he took his time and did a bunch of cool stuff. It was really great.
Yeah. He's,
and you're right. There's
so
no way that would have happened in normal situations. Like, I've done records with him in person before, but yeah, I mean, it's always like pretty quick, and
yeah,
I think the more time was taken.
Yeah, totally. Self-producing, he's probably just like, ooh, this would be cool. Oh, this would be cool. You're allowed this freedom to really just like explore your own mind and what you would do, which is cool.
So when you're dealing with all these different people sending tracks out, how instructive were you being about what you were looking for?
Not really at all. I mean, that's the benefit of having, you know, really accomplished musicians who you admire and trust. It's like you kind of don't want to give them any direction. You just want them to be them.
Right.
You know, it was mostly like, just do you. Just do your thing. Maybe we'd give like a song reference of like a feel, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, the only things that we kind of had to get a little bit more specific on were songs that had really strange time signature changes, like Juniper Woodsmoke or Feel, where it
was
just like, it was kind of just like a little bit instructive on, you know, the technicality of that.
Yeah. So on tunes like that, where normally like in a recording situation, you might just kind of like eyeball each other and be able to navigate something like that in real time. But in this case, were you like cutting those chunks of songs up into separate chunks or something, or how did you deal with that?
No, like a song like Feel, I mean, Jesse and Richard play together all the time, and Richard played on Feel.
What does Richard play?
Richard plays drums.
Oh, okay.
Richard Millsap is a great drummer.
Oh, okay.
They were in the band of Heathens together.
Right.
And now they both play in John Fogerty's band together, the two of those guys, Richard Millsap and Jesse Wilson.
Okay.
And they're just like an amazing rhythm section. So they sort of have like this familiarity just of playing for so many years together and their brother-in-laws, and they just could kind of like communicate through the wires, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
And anything, any rub that like felt, you know, not quite there, we were able to just sort of like smear a sound on and just smooth it out, you know.
Yeah.
And I give a lot of credit to Steve Christensen, who mixed the record. He's amazing. He's done like all the Krungbin records, and he's in Texas. I think he's in Houston. Houston or Dallas? Houston. And they're all friends with each other, too. So it was just...
It was a big friend fest.
Yeah, big friend fest, yeah.
How involved did you get in the mixing process?
Not very. Jesse went out to Texas. I did not. I don't remember why. I think I had probably some like animal situation to deal with at home or something like that. Okay. And, you know, I think with mixing, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen, it just is not beneficial. So I trust those guys implicitly. And it was, you know, I think Jesse was there for a week and then Steve maybe spent, you know, 3 or 4 more days doing it. And we called it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the sound of it, like the sonics of the record are really cohesive. Was that a tricky thing to accomplish with sending out tracks and doing the mixing, not being there and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, I wish Jesse was here to answer that question because he really took the reins on that, being the producer and Steve. But it seemed, you know, it seemed, I don't remember anybody tearing out their hair.
That's good.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't really mind not being involved so much in the mixing process. I mean, I was listening to roughs and I was listening to mixes and I was listening as they developed and I gave my notes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, just getting Steve Christensen to mix it, it was like, I like what he does, you know.
So it wasn't a stretch.
Right.
Yeah. So what was your actual process? I find that the whole remote recording thing pretty fascinating because people did approach it differently. And you play guitar. You also play some keys, right?
No, I actually don't play. I do write on guitar and keys, okay. But I let better performers track.
Is it Kai?
Kai Welch played keys on some songs. Jesse Welch. Jesse played all over the record. I mean, he plays
everything.
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of let...
So where do you know him from?
So Jesse and I met actually during Americana Fest in 2018.
Okay.
I was playing one of those tributes at the Basement East. Mm-hmm. And I was singing on stage. I was singing Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E, which I had just come off of a divorce of my own. It was sort of like this, you know, end wrap of like, it meant something. Yeah, I got off the stage and he was standing side stage and he was just really friendly. He's like, hey, you need anything? I was like, actually, I do. I'd love a PBR. And he got me a PBR and we just kind of kept
the rest is history.
Hanging out and the rest is history.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so thanks,
cool.
Basement East.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good scene there. I like that whole vibe they do during Americana.
Yeah.
Proactive.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Good.
It is.
Okay, so you were living together at the time, like during COVID.
Well, we weren't going to. So Jesse at the time was living in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
And I was living out here, and he moved out to Nashville like February 2020, and he got a room at Kai Welch's house. He was living at Kai's house.
Okay.
Because we were, you know, being smart about not rushing into things.
Right.
And I underwent a surgery March 3rd. My mother flew out from the West Coast. And that night, March 3rd, the tornado hit.
Oh, right.
And Jesse and my mom were taking care of me. I was in the hospital for about a week. We came home post-tornado. And then COVID came. So we all ended up like living together for a month. My mom,
with your mom,
my new boyfriend, and who had just moved to town.
Oh my God.
And I was just, you know, on painkillers. I had had, you know, open abdominal surgery.
Oh my
I was
God.
Like totally out of it. And then, yeah, my mom was kind of stuck. And, you know, Jesse didn't really want to keep going back and forth from Kai's house to my house and exposing people.
Yeah.
So by default, we just sort of started living together.
Funny way to have that happen.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was an action-packed kickoff to the pandemic.
Whoa. How long did your mom stay with you?
She ended up being here, I think, a month.
Wow. Okay.
You know, but it was like stressful because it was like, is she going to get out? Are the airlines going to close?
Yeah.
I remember her talking to the airline agent and being like, if you want to get on a plane, do it sooner than later because we don't know what's going to happen.
I was on tour that week too. Like I was out with we were opening for the Wood Brothers and we got to Oregon. We were actually headed to that little town in Washington where everything started, whatever it's called.
Oh.
It's some weird city. there was an old folks home that had the first COVID outbreak in America and we were going there to play a gig. It was some private gig or something. And That never happened.
Oof. Thank goodness.
Yeah. So you're here, you're holed up. How long was it before you started thinking, hey, we should make a record?
I think it was probably beginning of summer 2020, and I was still kind of writing at that time. I mean, the amount of time that I spent writing probably spanned from about 2018 to 2020, so about 2 year period. Mm-hmm. But I was still kind of writing into the summer. Like the last ones that I wrote were like Sweet Surrender and Wheels Rolling. But yeah, it, and again, you know, we thought when we started we were making demos and it just sort of organically became something that we thought was good enough to use. And so we were sort of surprised that the process was working as well as it was.
So how much of the tracks that you were sending out to people to play on were you actually keeping, or were you getting stuff back and then like redoing your stuff? This is where everyone kind of like has different approaches.
I mean, so we did have 3 full days in an actual studio at the end where I sang all my vocal tracks.
Oh, okay.
And we did some overdubs.
Yeah.
And I was able to sing with Oliver Wood on Friends and AJ Croce on Love Despair, just so we could like do the duets in person. It's just so much better.
Yeah. Did you do the Oliver stuff at his place?
Overall? No, we did it all at Compass Records.
Okay.
Yep, so down on Music Row.
That's the studio, which, what's it called?
It's called Compass Records, and they're also my record label, yeah.
Is that the one that they did, like, John Hartford Aeroplane record?
They may have. I know that that building has a lot of history, and it's a lot of, like, the old Outlaw Country guys used to be in that building.
I think that's the one. Yeah, I've done a couple sessions there. And okay. It's like, that's,
yeah, it's like the offices downstairs, upstairs studio, big control room.
And they used to do, we did an interview there, too, for Bluegrass.
That makes sense.
Or whatever it was. I can't remember what the show was, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a cool studio.
It is.
So that was provided to you by the label, and you got to go in there. And
yep.
Awesome.
Yep, it was great. It was nice. It felt really good to get in real person time, you know.
So you redid all, you recut all your vocals there.
Yep.
And what else did you do in those last few days?
I think Kai played a bunch of keys, and, you know, we did a bunch of BGVs, overdubs, maybe some guitar, but not really much. I mean, those 3 days really were dedicated to vocals.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you approach sing? Like, the vocal sound is great on that. You sing really well. Is it, how do you approach actually singing in the studio when you know you've got sort of a finite time? It's like the end of the process. Do you like that, doing it that way?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you asked that because I had just come off of doing a session in LA. This really strange gig, which was basically being a vocal stunt double for a television show.
Oh, really?
That's going to be like a musical television show.
Yeah.
And Blake Mills is doing the music. And I went in for 3 weeks and worked with Blake on creating this like character. And we had about, I don't know, 15, 20 songs that I was to sing as this character. And
this is a in-person dramatic show or like an animated show?
No, this is an in-person. So the lead of the show is not necessarily like a singer first. Okay. She's an actress first.
Yeah.
She can sing, but they wanted to lay down like vocal tracks that she could practice to. And, you know,
okay,
whether they may use them or not, I still haven't heard.
Are you That's allowed to TV say what the show is?
I don't think I should.
Okay.
But maybe we can put it in the notes if I get allowance or something like that. But anyway.
So you are singing.
I'm singing.
The actress is pretending to sing.
Yes.
Or is singing on top of your track.
That's yet to be known. My job at the time was to lay down tracks for her to listen to and learn from.
Okay.
So when I was doing that, and Blake is so particular and specific. It was really fun to work with him because normally I would go in to a recording session and just sing, just be me. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun to go in and sing and be somebody else. Like, he's very specific, and he had very good, he's a really great vocal producer, mm-hmm. in that he'd be like, can we make it sound a little bit like, more like this, try scrunching your face, try frowning when you're singing this song. Just, he gave me all these like different techniques I'd never tried before to mm-hmm. make my voice sort of like altered in different ways.
Yeah.
And it just made me, and we'd spend like a full day on one, singing wow. one song. And it was like, I didn't know you could spend that much time singing a song.
Yeah.
And it just really put that like idea in my head that vocal production is really important, and it's really important to spend time singing your songs. Uh-huh. You know, it's fun to just do off the cuff. You know, I always think like, well, Aretha Franklin, she just does it all in one take, and it's all the tape, and, you know, and uh-huh. it's like, yes, the organicness of it is good, and when you're as good as Aretha, that's super awesome and amazing, and I'm sure she's also had sessions where she spends longer. But my point is, it was the first time I had really thought of spending time tracking my vocals instead okay. of just like throwing it down. Yeah. So that's actually why I grabbed Kai to get into the studio with me for those 3 days at Compass, because I feel like he and Blake actually are similar in mm-hmm. their like attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And Kai is such a great singer, and he has such great like feel for like what, you know, emphasis to put on this word or that. And that was what I loved about Blake too, like putting emphasis differently on one word can change the whole feel of a song.
Totally.
Like Sweet Surrender, it was sung, the chorus was sung totally different, and Kai was like, what if you push this instead, and it became this whole different song, you
wow,
know?
That's cool.
So,
like after it had all been tracked,
yeah.
just in the delivery.
Yes.
So cool.
Yeah. So it just really kind of allowed me, working with Blake for that television show, allowed me to kind of like indulge in mm-hmm. my own process of recording vocal tracks. I think that I'd always been like, oh, I can be last, you know, whatever, I'll just throw it down. Yeah. And it's like, no. It's okay to spend time tracking your vocals.
That's so cool.
You know?
So give me a rundown on how you would actually do it then. So would you do like 5 passes and comp them, or would you just sit there and sort of labor over a line until you had it perfect and then move on, or what?
With Blake?
No.
Or with Kai?
With Kai and
Jesse.
On this new record.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends. Like, Leaving Me is the loving thing to do. It's the ballad that yep. James Pennebaker just crushes the solo on. Mm-hmm. I sang that 3 times.
Top to bottom.
Yeah. And I think we chose the last one and maybe grabbed a line from the first take or something like
and
that.
And you're involved in that process.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. There's still stuff, vocal stuff on the record where there's one thing where I'm just like, ugh, you know, I'd love to go back and fix. But there's also, you know, like the time comes when you're like, okay, it's just done.
Yeah.
You know.
I'll say.
So
what's another example of one that would have been more intensive than that?
Let me think. Feel was kind of strange and a little bit hard just for the timing, you know?
Right.
Like, it's the most simple song on the record, but the timing of it was like, that was probably the most challenging one for me because we were also sort of crunched for time. We had 3 days to do all 10 songs. And I get easily frustrated with myself, but that, oddly, as simple as the song is, was probably the hardest one for me to just get the feel of. Mm-hmm. And then once I get something...
So was that just a matter of repetition
yes.
for you?
Okay. Yes.
So you just had to sing it a gazillion times.
Yeah, I probably sang that. I mean, not a gazillion, but I probably, you know, I probably touched that one, you know, 10 to 15 times.
Yeah. Top to bottom again? Or
probably.
Do you sit there and, like, hit lines after?
I mean, I usually will sing through stuff, you know, at least a few times. And then if we need to go back and grab lines, I can do that. But I do like to have an organic cohesiveness to the take, especially that's why it was so cool in Leaving Me is a Loving Thing to Do, because it's so emotional. Mm-hmm. And it was such a like moment for me just being in that. I didn't really want to grab and patchwork it together.
So how
I
did you do
it.
That one?
That one was just...
Straight,
you
live.
Know, yeah, yeah.
Just you?
No, actually, no. Kai sings BGVs on that. And actually, Erin Ray sings on that, too. She sings BGVs
oh, okay.
on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the choruses
have that. So in those 3 days, you
thing.
Did those all the backup vocals as well, the Kai's stuff?
Erin did hers remotely.
Okay. Did you have those done before you'd done the final vocal?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I think I sent it to Aaron after Kai and I had already
signed off, sent it to Aaron, said, have at her. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about a song like Feel. Carl Denson's on that.
Yes.
What's your, do you have a history with him of some sort?
I do. I have a deep history with Carl. I've known him for so long. I actually sang on his record, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 records ago.
Okay.
How did I first meet Carl? I don't even remember.
You're kind of like tied into the jam scene in an unusual way for a singer-songwriter.
Yes, it's because of my association probably with Phil Lesh.
What's your association with Phil Lesh?
I play with Phil a bunch when he does his Phil and Friends stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm from San Francisco. Yeah. I'm actually from the East Bay, but I spent many years living in San Francisco and Marin County. And Phil had a great venue and restaurant called Terrapin Crossroads.
Had? He doesn't have it anymore?
No, it sadly closed.
Oh.
It was open for about 10 years. But when he launched that first week, he played, every night for, I think, like 10 days. And I was part of that opening band.
Okay.
Yeah. It was like me and Chris Robinson and my husband at the time, Tim, and I think Ross James and Graham Lesh. And
I know Graham a little bit. We played together.
He's great. I love Graham. But yeah, so that relationship, you know, began.
That was your initial relationship with him?
I think it predated that. I think I met Phil originally through my friend Jackie Green, who had us both up. He was playing the Fillmore. And I think the first time I met Phil was when we were both sitting in with Jackie as guests.
Okay.
And I just remember standing next to Phil and being like, my brother is going to think I'm so cool. I have 2 older brothers, and one of them is a huge Deadhead. So that was kind of a cool moment for me.
Yeah.
It's been a really fun journey with Phil. I mean, I just respect and admire him so much, and I love playing with him. And, you know, and then I would go on jam cruise and, you know, do all the festivals,
So jam whenever he does Phil and Friends, you're in that?
No, he changes it up.
Okay.
So it just depends. Like, we just did a bunch. It was Dawes and me and Phil and Graham. We did a few shows at the Brooklyn Bowl here in Nashville. We just did Asbury Park. I don't know when this is going to air, and it hasn't been announced yet, but we have some dates coming up.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just you get the call and you do it because it's Phil. And
so what's the material when you do those shows?
Grateful Dead.
It is? Yeah. All Dead?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I haven't seen one of those Phil and Friends things, but I would like to.
Oh, yeah, they're fun. I mean, if you like those songs, it's just...
Oh, sure.
It's so fun. And then when you hear... You know, I've done it in many different renditions, but doing it with Dawes is really fun because they're all just, like, so pro, and they're such great singers, and it's so fun for me as a singer to sing with them because the harmonies are just, like, so lush and full. And
right.
It's a special combination.
Coming from the San Francisco music scene, was the Dead a big part of your life?
Totally.
It was.
Of course. Okay. Yeah. I mean, and I had an older brother who was like the coolest person in my life, and that's basically all he listened to. So I sort of got some early schooling, which helped, you know.
It helps having an older brother Deadhead sometimes.
Yeah, it does. It does. And just in the area, I mean, that's just like what people listen to. You know, it's just kind of constantly on. Boyfriends that I had, you know.
What's your favorite kind of era of the Dead? Or do you like it all?
I mean, I loved when Pigpen was alive because I love the blues stuff. I love Pigpen's voice. Yeah. Easy Wind is like one of my favorite songs, and I love doing it. I love when Phil puts that on the set list because it's so fun to sing.
Yeah.
I love Working Man's Dead.
Pretty strong era.
Yeah,
especially
for
the songs. That's probably the strongest era around then, and American Beauty and all that stuff.
Yeah, classic.
And then live too, they were like firing on all cylinders in the early 70s too.
Yeah,
even when Pigpen wasn't really firing on all cylinders, they were
totally.
They sounded really good, solid back then.
Yeah, I mean, Europe 72. That's like iconic.
Good. Yeah, tell me a little bit about the San Francisco music scene. So you were coming up there, like, in the 90s, early 2000s? What was your...
No, well, let's see. It was the later... So I was not planning on a career in music at all whatsoever.
Okay.
I went to school. I studied environmental studies. I thought I was going to go into a line of like environmental law or something like that. And I broke my foot really badly my junior year of college. And I graduated from college and I had to get a surgery, which took a really long time to recover from. And I wasn't going to be like going out in the field doing any environmental stuff. And my dad suggested.
You were in San Francisco still?
Yes. Yeah. My dad suggested that I get a teaching credential. So I went back to school. Mm. I got a teaching credential, K through five.
This whole time you're not playing music?
No, not playing music. I mean, I owned a guitar.
Okay.
You know, but I was playing in my bedroom, but I was not.
No gigs.
I went back to school, got a teaching credential. Out of college, this was probably 2002.
Yeah.
Out of college, it was really hard to find a teaching job, and the only job I could find was working as a teacher's assistant at an autistic school.
Okay.
And it was amazing, but it was really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I think teachers should be making as much as doctors. Like, mm-hmm. It's insane how hard it is to be a teacher, especially to special ed, which I had no training in special ed. So I got super spooked and I was like, this is too much. I can't do this.
Right.
So I went back to like my comfort zone, which is horses. And I got a job working at a private ranch in Rancho Santa Fe. I was living in San Diego at the time.
Did you grow up around horses or something?
Yes, I did.
Like on a ranch or something?
No, I just grew up riding.
Okay.
Hunter jumper world. I was really into it. I loved,
wow.
I mean, it's.
That's intense.
Yeah. It's where I got like every scrap of confidence I have was from horses.
Amazing.
And I was very dedicated to it. So I got a job working as a groom and taking care. I was really a barn manager, taking care of about 8 horses at the time. And I loved it. It was amazing.
That's such a left turn from what you were doing before that.
Yeah. I mean, I've always had kind of like environment teaching horses. Those were like my avenues. And I'd go to see shows. I'd go to see live shows. You know,
you were interested
I loved
in music.
Like, yeah. Yes. And anytime I would go see a show, I always wanted to be like closer to the stage or behind the stage. Like I didn't know what that feeling was, but it was like very strong.
What was the scene going like? Were there bands that you would like to go and see on a regular basis in those years in that area?
Totally. I mean, so the Mother Hips were probably one of my favorite bands at the time. And that's kind of when my world changed, is they played a New Year's Eve show in San Diego at the Casbah and invited me back to a party. And we were passing around the guitar and it landed in my lap and I was drunk enough to play a song. And Tim, the frontman of the Mother Hips, was like, I didn't know you sang. Come to San Francisco. Let's make a record. And that's like literally... Whoa. How it
What did you
started.
Say?
I sang Statesboro Blues.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Allman Brothers.
All right.
Easy blues song.
Yeah.
I'm not a great guitar player, you know, so I always revert to the blues. It's my comfort zone.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And so that's what happened. So you did? You went and made a record?
So I did, yeah. And I kind of left and I was like, whatever. That was cool. It felt good that he, you know, took note of my voice and was interested in me as a singer, but I never thought he would call. I kind of just left that party being like, oh, that was cool. Good way to start the new year.
Yeah.
And he did call. Mm-hmm. And he asked when I was coming to San Francisco next. And I said, I don't have any plans. And he said, well, I think you should, because we should start tracking some songs.
Okay.
So I did.
Wow.
And my family was up in San Francisco, so...
Where were you at this time?
I was in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So did he have a studio or something? Or?
He had a little... It was a basement apartment of a beautiful house in the Cowhollow area of San Francisco that his friend owned, and he had his living quarters and his studio was all one.
Okay.
And he called it Pacific Dust.
Pacific Dust.
Yeah.
And?
I mean, like, the drums were in the kitchen of the studio apartment.
Okay.
You know, it was, like, tiny.
Right.
Yeah.
And you cut the whole record that way.
Yeah.
In that one place.
Yeah.
This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use Isotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to isotope.com/soulpod, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra-tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Also thanks to Ear Trumpet Labs, a workshop in Portland, Oregon, hand-building amazing-sounding microphones. These large diaphragm condensers combine state-of-the-art sound with eye-catching designs and the feedback control to excel live as well as in the studio. I am using their Edwina myself right now on this podcast. Check them out at eartrumpetlabs.com. And finally, the Hen House Hang. It's a four-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville on September 19 to 22, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right, then, let's get back to the show.
Is that the first Nikki Bloom record?
Yes, that's okay. Toby's song. It was my first record.
And that's like 08 or?
Yes, exactly.
Like that. Wow, that's crazy. So that came out, and then like, were you suddenly, hey, I'm going to go on tour? Like, how does that even translate to you?
No.
How did you know how to put a record out?
Well, I mean, I didn't. So I moved to San Francisco because Tim and I's relationship developed.
Yeah.
And
this was who you ended up marrying.
This is who I ended up marrying. Okay. Yep. And we made that record. And when it was finished, I wanted to play a show. And I wanted the show to sound like the record.
Yeah.
So I put a band together, which included my childhood friend, Darren Ney, Steve Adams, a bass player of ALO, Mike Curry, Tim Bloom, and actually, I'm not even sure that Steve. Anyway, the early, you know, lineup of the band was put together for that show.
And so was that the first time you'd ever been on stage?
Yes, I think so.
Holy shit, that's crazy.
I think so. I might have played I had like done some open mics and, you know, maybe opened a show as like a solo artist or a duo. But yeah, I was super green.
Yeah.
Super green. And we played the show and it was super fun.
Where? What was the venue?
Café du Nord.
Yeah.
In San Francisco, which I don't even know if it was there, if it's there anymore, but it was a really fun little room to play. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we just, you know, played the show. And I was, at the time, teaching in San Francisco. I had moved up there. I was teaching environmental ed out at Fort Funston.
At a high school or something?
No, elementary. It was like a STAR school program where we went to underserved schools in the district and taught them environmental ed.
Okay.
It was great. It was a really fun, rewarding job. It was really hard because working with youth is hard, as I mentioned.
Tell me about it.
And then I started, you know, I gave up that job and I started substitute teaching because that would allow me more flexibility, you know. And I was subbing and trying to continue playing shows. And when the scales tipped and I, you know, was...
So were you touring?
Touring more.
Like regionally or nationally?
Regionally.
Northern California.
Yeah, Northern California. I mean, I give a lot of credit to Tim in forcing me to tour because I didn't know how to do anything. And he was like, it was really when we made my second record, Driftwood, in 2011, that he was like, you need to tour. And I remember just being really overwhelmed. Like, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know.
You didn't have like a management or agent or anything like that?
I had an agent early on, Joshua Knight. he's now at Wasserman, which was Paradigm, which was Monterey International.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Joshua really took me under his wing. God bless him. And I, you know, I was with him for many, many years. We just parted ways because, you know, he got so busy with so many artists. But he was like a really early believer in me, and I still love him. He's like a brother. He started booking shows for me, and I learned how to tour, and I was terrified. And, you know, I just like
touring with a full band
out.
Or
touring
just
with a full band.
Okay. That's
yeah.
hard.
After Driftwood came out.
Around 2011, 12.
Yep. Kinda. Yep. Yeah. We just got in the van and we just started doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
And at that point, were you getting out of California?
We were doing a lot in California. I'm trying to think. We were doing a lot of touring.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were on the road a lot. When you tour out west, any musician can touring musician can tell you this. It's like the drives are incredibly long. It's not like being in the Southeast.
I'm from Canada.
Or
tell
being
me about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like your drives can be long.
Yeah.
And we started doing this thing on tour where we would be super bored and we'd record learn like songs from our youth that were nostalgic, and we would record versions of them
cool.
in our van.
Yeah.
You know, I'd put like the iPhone on the rearview mirror and we would play, you know, cover songs with these little instruments in the van as we were driving along and yeah. going from show to show. And we had some really weird random attention with that. We did a Hall & Oates song and
Okay, so you were putting them up on YouTube.
Putting them up on YouTube.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? Okay.
And
what were some of the other ones that you did?
We did, I mean, we've done Whitney Houston, Pat Benatar, Bobby Darin, Grateful Dead.
So
I mean, there's like
driving,
35.
Everyone else is arranging.
Yeah, I'm driving. And so we would turn the iPhone microphone to be on the driver's side. And then we would literally mix the sound by moving
people.
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually really fun. And I can't believe how good it sounds considering, you know,
right.
It's just an iPhone. It's
sometimes
crazy.
Those things sound pretty good.
I mean, it's not good enough to like, you know, we thought for a while, oh, maybe we should like take these and put them.
Make a record.
Make
of
a record. But no, they're not that good.
Yeah.
It's
but on YouTube,
spirit.
They sound fun.
Yeah. And it's the spirit of
yeah.
it. You know, it was fun. I remember people being like, that's dangerous. And I'm thinking to myself, do you
oh,
not sing when you drive? Is that, you're not using your mouth at the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And I was always driving.
So was that something that got you a lot of attention? I was not aware
yes.
that you, okay. So
yeah.
that was like a thing.
So
that,
that was
thing.
Why, yes, because
okay.
because John Oates saw it. God bless him. I love you, John Oates. He saw it, and Twitter at the time was like all the thing, and I think he tweeted it, and then
oh,
it
wow.
was like
okay.
the power of social media. It was like Cameron Crowe retweeted it, and Bette Midler retweeted
oh
it,
my God.
And Anthony Mason calls, and we're suddenly on, you know, The Morning Show, and then we're on Conan, and it was crazy, and that's what demanded us to go to...
All from that stuff.
All from that stuff.
Oh, my God, that's nuts.
That's what demanded us to start touring nationally, because we would start getting offers in, like, Birmingham. We're like, Birmingham? Well, if we're going to drive all the way out to Birmingham, we better string it together, and that's what made us start
so
touring
outside
California. So you
did the Conan show based off of... These
I mean,
videos?
No, I mean, we were working really hard.
Yeah.
We were touring a lot. We were doing a residency in San Francisco. We were playing kind of nonstop. I mean, we had that little kickstart from the cover songs, but we were really adamant about redirecting people to our original
right.
music.
Sort of like Lake Street Dive in a way, I guess.
Very much so.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you see that translate to like bigger crowds, like exponentially as the attention grew for that stuff?
You know, this is where it just gets so slippery and there's no like linear
right.
way to music. We for a while, you know, people would come and I think people would come thinking that we were going to do a lot more covers than
oh,
we
yeah.
did. And we were really adamant about not doing covers.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would like maybe do one or maybe we would go to the merch table and do like one acoustically and people loved it. But mm-hmm. it really didn't last.
Right.
It didn't.
Yeah, you don't want to be saddled with that thing as
no.
your career, that's
no.
for sure.
No.
So you have to kind of probably just put a line in the sand and say,
yep.
it's not what we're doing here.
And you have to think, too, you know, like that was a really the eyes on the YouTube stuff was a lot of people like in their office, sitting at their desk, passing it around. It's not like live music goers. It was just this really weird blip phenomenon thing crazy. That happened.
So was this Nikki Bloom or was this Gramblers or what was
This was
it?
Nikki Bloom and the Gramblers.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep. So we kind of rode that out and, you know, we did what we could with it. We made two records, yep. self-titled Nikki Bloom and the Gramblers, and then a record called Loved, Wild, Lost, and continued touring, you know, and we were really wanting to, you know, to go at it. Things changed. Everything, you know, good comes to an end. The inner workings of our world and the dynamics started to change. My marriage sort of started to, you know, get strained, and so... You know, it had its time, mm-hmm. and it was a really fun time.
Did you eventually just say, that's the end of this band, I'm not doing this anymore? Or like, it just was there a finite ending to it?
I was going through a lot personally. You know, Tim was my mentor and my partner, yeah. and, you know, I considered him the band leader, and I looked to him for a lot of... you know, guidance, and he was also my main writing partner. And when our relationship sort of disintegrated, I kind of lost my musical partner and my writing partner. And at the time, my management said, why don't you start going out to Nashville and write with writers? And I didn't really know that this world existed. I didn't realize that, you know, co-writing is a thing and you come here and you do it. And so I came out on a couple trips, and I actually stayed in this neighborhood. I stayed at Langhorne Slim's house, and
this
loved
is like
it.
Around 2015-ish?
This is 2016.
Okay.
Yeah, 2016. And I came to Nashville in the spring, and it's like...
Lovely.
Yeah, easy to fall in love.
16 days.
Everything's blooming, and everything's gorgeous, and, you know, the walkability of East Nashville. I mean, I was just like, what is this place? This is amazing. And you get to go and write with people, and it's free, and I feel like I'm going to therapy sessions. And I ended up finishing writing for my record that I would then move on to record in Memphis with Matt Rossbang, and we made a record called To Rise, You Gotta Fall, just as I had moved to Nashville.
Okay.
So when I moved to Nashville, I basically went straight into the studio down in Memphis, made that record with Matt, and that was the first break from the Gramblers, where I knew that I really wanted to go into the studio and have the only baggage I brought in be the words on the page, because my songs were so topical and they were filled with so much pain through my transition, you know, out of my marriage and getting a divorce. And just, you know, you're in a band for 10 years, there's like drama that ensues. It's inevitable. And I just had a lot of pain, and I felt really strongly at the time that it was scarier to stay in the known than it was to step into the unknown. Okay. And that's when I just was like, I need to move. I need to record my record. I needed a clean slate. I really did. It was just, it was all so painful.
Did you ever have any like...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Real confidence issues with like writing in particular, having, you know, years where you had co-writer/mentor or whatever with Tim, to suddenly kind of being on your own as far as the creative process goes. Was that like ever a problem for you?
Yeah, I mean, it still is.
Yeah.
Like, I constantly am doubting myself. My inner critic is really strong, and my work now is to like be nice to myself. And, you know, you want to have a bit of the inner critic turned on because you don't want to churn out shit, but you also need to have like a kindness, you know, in yourself. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely, you know, a work in progress. I think that's like life work, you know. And it's hard to write a great song. It really is. And, you know, I found some incredible writing partners, Jesse being one. I love writing with Kai. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Was that stuff that was set up like through your label or publisher or anything like that? Or were you kind of organically finding all those co-writing people?
For my last record, Try As You Gotta Fall, I was set up on rights. Simon Gugela was probably my favorite person to write with. He helped me work through so many challenging issues. And I just remember showing up at his house to write and, you know, sitting down with him. And we just really were conversational. We were talking about our life. And, you know, he's like, gosh, this is just so refreshing that I don't have to write a song about cars and chicks. And I was like, really? That's what you do? And so Simon,
welcome to Nashville.
Yeah, Simon was a great early co-write experience for me. And, you know, now as I am deeper into the community and I've made friends, it's a lot more organic of a writing process. But I would love to, you know, discipline myself more and start to be set up on rights and, you know, get back into that world post-COVID. Because I think it's good to be uncomfortable and I think it's good to broaden your scope of people and, you know, it's fun. I like co-writing. I think that it's fun to get people's perspective, and I love when it can be conversational. And
that's cool. It's not for everybody. It's cool that you dig it.
I do. Mm. I mean, you know, when it's right, I dig it.
So you had a batch of songs. How did you hook up with Matt? I've done some stuff with Matt. That's a good little scene he's
got
going over there.
Ugh, I just love him.
Sam Phillips?
We did. Yep, yeah. We worked at Sam Phillips. I think my manager at the time, Dan Kaysen, connected me with Matt. We just both were admirers of his work, the Iron and Wine record that he did. And, you know, I just knew that I needed to have a strong lead. And he was amazing because he put the band together.
Yeah.
And
all Memphis people?
All Memphis people, except Ken Coomer, who played drums. He's a Nashville guy.
Who were the other players on that record?
Dave Smith played bass. Ken played drums. Will Sexton played guitar.
Oh, yeah.
Al Gamble played keys. And Rick Steff played piano. I mean, they're just, it was so fun. And they play a lot together. So I kind of walked into this, like, very comfy vibe.
And you guys were in that big tracking room area.
Yeah. Yep, and we tracked everything live.
Great.
And it was
including
so fun. Including my vocals, which Matt would not let me replace.
Right.
Yep. Thanks, Matt. Which, you know, that whole thing, that was the first time I ever really had fun recording because it was not overthought. It was not sitting at a computer.
Right.
It was not cutting stuff up. It was, like, organic, and it was fun, and it was, it really was the, it, I can't even tell you how cathartic that process was for me, coming out of the situation that I was in and going into Matt Rosbang's happy-go-lucky vibe. Yes, he was the perfect person for me at that time in my life, and he put together the perfect band, and I will always be so filled with gratitude for that time in
my
life.
It's great to have like a really accurate snapshot too of like that time. So did you do it all in like 4 or 5 days kind of thing? Or?
I think we had the band for 7 days, maybe 10 days. And then I think I stayed an extra week and, you know, we did overdubs and we had Sam Shoup come in and arrange, you know, strings and, you know, we put all the icing on and I stayed for all of that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a scene. Have you seen his new place?
We saw it when it wasn't done. So I need to, I'm due for a visit to him to see the finished product.
That's such a crazy place.
I know.
What is it called? Is it Crossroads?
No.
Crosstown?
Oh, yeah. The whole building. And then he's calling his place Southern
Groove.
Oh,
yeah, has he decided?
Southern Groove.
Oh, Southern Groove. Okay, last time I talked to him, it was unclear.
Yep, me too, I know.
Southern Groove, okay.
Yeah, and it's awesome. It looks awesome. And he has such great taste in, like, colors and furniture. And, I mean, it's beautiful.
I want to go there.
Yeah, me too.
I was there, too, also when it was not finished. I mixed a thing with him last year, and we did it at Sam Phillips. It was one of the last things he did there before he moved. But I did get to see the new place in sort of three-quarters completion mode, which is cool.
So cool.
So that's a totally different experience for you. And then the new record was, again, like a completely, obviously, different experience because of the whole COVID situation.
Totally.
So going forward, if you're going to make another record, how would you, I mean, you've done it all. How would you approach, do you think? Or have you started another record or anything like that? It's a little early, probably.
Well, we actually did just start tracking yesterday, just a demo. You know, Jesse and I are building a studio at our house. It'll be a modest studio, but it should be enough that we can, you know.
So what's that going to look like?
Make records.
In the house?
It's a detached garage that we're converting.
Kind of like this place.
Yeah, it's not quite as nice yet. But yeah, we're,
one
you know,
floor,
so many resources.
Kind of vibe?
It's two floors. So it's a two-car garage. And then they had an attic that was really meant for storage.
Yeah.
And I bit off a bit more than I could chew. I got a contractor, Don Corey, in town to help me build out the attic.
So that's done.
The attic is done. So we've got like we've got the control room, which is now control room / live room. Like there's drums. Like it's way too crowded up there right now because we need to do the downstairs, and the downstairs will be the live room. But it's all wired.
Currently, just a big garage.
Big garage. Okay. Yeah. But we did have the foresight to, you know, create wire drops.
Yeah.
So, you know, ideally it would be that. But I do love the collaborative effort. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it would. And I would love to work with Matt again in some way, shape, or form. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't figured it out. But what I love about working with both Matt and Jesse is Matt has this like Memphis thing, obviously, and Jesse has this California thing. And I feel like the California Memphis, I sort of joked around and was like, it's like Cali Memphis is my sound. You know, people are always like begging for you to tell them what your music sounds like and what the genre is. And I hate that because it's just impossible. But it's like that California Memphis vibe I really
that.
Like.
I hear that on the new record for sure.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad. Cali Memphis, that's the genre.
I mean, there's soul, there's country, there's all that stuff. It's all mixed in there.
Yeah, but my point is I love to do things from the comfort of home because I love how easy it is to just organically be like, you want to, let's go track, let's go.
So is the intention for that place that you're building to just do your own stuff in, or is it going to be like a commercial space of some sort?
It won't be commercial, but you know, Jesse's already working on like three more records. Friends.
Yeah.
He's working with Zach Schmidt, who's a local artist here who's fantastic. He just finished doing some stuff with Austin Gillette, who's actually a pro skateboarder and also musician.
Amazing.
Jesse and Dom Billet and Austin just finished making a record. So, you know, little projects of friends and stuff he believes in. And, you know, he's also an artist in his own right, and he's constantly working. He's constantly up there, probably the same way you are. You know, he doesn't turn it off. So I just need to go up there and knock on the door and be like, can we work on one of mine? It's kind of like that.
Okay. And are you a prolific writer, or does it take you forever, or what's your situation?
You know, I'm a prolific jotter downer.
Okay.
Of
do you have a lot of notebooks?
Ideas. I have a lot of notebooks, and I have a lot of like song starts, tons of voice memos. I actually just was sitting on the airplane, and the Wi-Fi wasn't working, so I couldn't watch anything, and I didn't feel like reading, and so I just started going through my voice memos. And I always think like
six albums that
there. I'm like, I always think I haven't done anything or written anything, and I'm always like lashing myself for not being disciplined enough. And then I go into my voice memos, and I have like all this cool shit, and I'm like, oh, I just need to develop this that I already have. And, you know,
I love that about voice memos in that you can jot something down, forget about it for a year. And then like that time, that forgetting it and that distance you are from something that you were working on for a day or something a year ago can really give you a different perspective on it that you might have originally just wanted to give up on or something. But it,
totally. Or you don't think it's good and then you have space and you're like, wait, actually, did I do that? That's yeah. cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of that kind of stuff.
I have a lot of that kind of stuff. It actually,
do you labor over stuff to finish it or do you?
Lyrically, maybe.
Okay.
Only because, you know, I used to be like, okay, cool. Yeah, that's good. That's good. And now that I'm in Nashville, I feel like I have a more critical eye on myself where mm-hmm. I will spend more time just wanting to distill, be more exact, you know, harness bigger concepts into tidy, you know, mm-hmm. neat songs. I want to cut the fat. So I'm always trying to do that.
Do you write songs to pitch to other people?
I would like to.
You haven't done that before, though.
I don't have a publishing deal right now. Okay. So I'm sort of looking for something like that. You know, it would be nice. I would be very open to it. And that's the beauty of the studio, too. I would love to get assignments and, right. you know, I can do it. I've got this amazing, you know, community of people that I love to work with. And we've got the studio space. So
yeah.
I'm open to all things.
You're into it.
I'm into it.
Let me just ask you about something you were talking about before, which I know you can't give the details on, but the movie thing that you were doing with Blake Mills. So how does something like that come about? Like, did Blake have that project and call you, or did you, like, what was the process for that? That's such a crazy thing.
Well, this is so mysterious because it's so weird. Like, you never really know, right? But, like, I think maybe what happened was during the pandemic, the band of Heathens were doing a weekly Good Time Supper Club where they would do like a variety show online and I would always be a guest and sing on that variety show.
Yeah.
And James Petrale was a guest on that show one week of White Denim. And James is the male vocal for this said television show.
Oh, okay. So he already had that gig.
Yes.
Okay.
And he is friends with the band of Heathens. And I think he was talking to one of the guys, maybe Trevor Nealon in the band, and maybe he had heard me sing on the show and maybe he recommended me to Blake. I don't really know. I don't actually really know. But the weird thing is that I just got a call from Tony Berg. So my phone rang with Tony Berg's number. And
did you know Tony
I met Tony because I was going to do my record with Tony in 2017.
Okay.
And then Ryan Adams came in and said he wanted to do my record. And he totally messed my life up for a second. But I turned down Tony because I thought Ryan was going to do my record. And then Ryan did his whole Ryan thing. And
I don't know what the Ryan
disappeared.
Thing is. He just like gives you a runaround.
And, yeah. Okay. He gave me the runaround. And that's how I ended up with Matt Rosbank.
Wow, crazy.
Which is a blessing. I mean, it's like sometimes, you know, the unanswered prayers are like the best thing in the world.
Why didn't you go back to Tony Berg?
I think that ship had sailed.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
Yeah.
But so it was cool to see Tony's name pop up on my phone.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, cool,
so
all these
him.
Years later.
Right.
And he was just like, Nikki, I've got the weirdest gig for you. You're never going to believe this. And that's how it happened.
And was he involved in the project?
So Tony and Blake share studio space.
Right, okay.
And, I mean, I think Tony was, like, Blake's first, you know, like, supporter. I mean, I remember Tony talking about Blake back in, you know, 2015.
I met Blake when he was 12.
Yeah. Tony was like, Tony's been singing Blake's praises for years and years and years and years. So, yes, Tony was involved with the project, but not on my side of it. I worked directly with Blake and Joseph Lorge, his engineer.
And the space, is it in Tony's house?
No, it's Sound City.
It's Sound City. So they have...
Is that right? Or Sunset Sound? I can't remember. I always get
No,
them
I think
confused.
You're right. I think it's Sound City. So they have like a half of the studio or something?
No, they have the whole studio.
The whole thing.
Blake is in Studio A and Tony's in Studio B.
They're just in there all the time.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They both show up in their matching Teslas. It's hilarious.
Of course.
They're amazing. The scene they have over there is just like so cool and fun.
Is it just a hive of craziness?
No. I mean, they're super pro. They're very.
But they're like.
They keep regular working hours.
Busy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Constantly busy.
So Blake was doing the score for the show?
Yes.
Okay. And this was like just something that was getting done for the show. And you were working on that for how long?
3 weeks.
Whoa.
3 weeks I was in LA. It was
crazy.
So fun. I loved it. I loved it so much. And that's the other thing. I would love to get more studio work. I mean, that would really be, because I don't, you know, I feel like the pandemic did one of two things for touring musicians. Either it made you really hungry for the road, or it made you really realize that you like sleeping in your own bed and having pets in a garden.
Yeah.
And I'm the latter.
Okay.
So I would love to get more studio work.
Okay.
Because I love singing. I love singing on other people's stuff.
I love singing
harmony.
Yeah.
I love singing in the studio. And now that we're set up, you know, I can do it remotely. I could do it in town. So, yeah.
Okay.
Putting it out there.
Good to know. Yeah. Put it into the universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's amazing. And the touring thing for you, are you doing it at all these days?
Yes.
You are. Okay.
Yeah.
And what does that look like for you?
So I've just decided to be really particular about what I do and what I don't. You know, I only want to do stuff that I feel really excited about.
Yeah.
I'm opening a bunch of shows for Little Feet this fall.
That's crazy.
Which I'm really excited about because I love them and I love their music.
Does that also go back to the whole Phil world? Like, do you have a connection with them?
I went to Jamaica with Little Feet. They put on a festival and they put me on their festival.
Okay.
And Bill Payne and I became friends because Bill is the coolest guy in the world.
Yeah, he's super cool.
And I love him.
He's been on the show.
He's amazing. And he and I became friends. And this is really funny. So they came to, they came to Nashville this summer to play two nights at the Ryman. And my friend Connor Kennedy, who is from Woodstock, was like, hey, can I come stay with you? I'm going to come down and see Little Feet. I might be singing with them. Actually, Bill was thinking that like he might want you to come and sing. BGV's at those shows. Are you going to be home? And I was like, well, yeah, I'll be home. I was actually in Colorado at the time, and I was flying back to Nashville. And I get on my plane, like, the next day after I had talked to Connor. And who am I sitting next to on my airplane? And it's, like, assigned seats. United assigned seats. I'm sitting next to Bill Payne. I sit down next to Bill Payne.
Now.
He looks at me and he goes, Nikki, I've been meaning to call you. And I'm like, Bill, I can't even believe this is happening. So anyway, it's just the universe really, it does work in funny,
that
mysterious ways. So yeah, so then he ended up saying, can you come and sing with us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're taping these shows.
Were those the Waiting for Columbus shows?
Cool. Yeah, yeah.
What'd you sing?
I sang background
on
all of them. And then I came up and sang Willin' with Jamie Johnson,
nice.
Which I think is the one they put on the recording.
What's happening with it? It's a live album or what?
Yeah, it's a live album and it's out. And it's also a DVD.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. You can get it at littlefeet.com.
Okay.
So that'll be fun. So touring, you know, I'm excited to go out and do really
things that I... So you're opening for the Feet and singing with them?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah.
And do you go out with a full band or just
this
you,
will be
or?
A duo. It'll be me and Jesse.
Okay.
Actually, Kai and I did a couple this summer as a duo, and it was really fun, you know, go out there for 30 minutes and play songs from the new record. And, you know, I would like to do maybe like a West Coast run or something
in the
spring.
But you're not burning to go out and hit the road.
I'm not.
Okay.
You know, I would like to play where there's demand, but I don't want to force it. And, you know, it's rough. I was in a van for 10 years with a bunch of dudes, and it was amazing, and I loved it. But I'm not chomping at the bit to, like, go do that in that capacity, you know. You know, you're always worrying about ticket sales and did we sell enough? You're always getting pressure. Steve Poltz says it great. He's like, God, on my tombstone, it's going to say, we need to sell more tickets, you know. It's just, like, it's very stressful and it's very hard on your ego to constantly put yourself in that position, you know.
Right.
It's just, you know, I've learned I want to protect my inner landscape and, you know, make it a hospitable place for me to live. And when I'm, you know, constantly putting it out there, it's crazy because musicians are, I think, depending on the kind of musicians, we're all pretty like introverted people, right? Thoughtful, thinking, you know, people. And then you're asked to like go be on this stage and go wear all of these hats and go be this extrovert. And you see the kind of wear, physical, mental, emotional wear it puts on on people. So I'm just, you know, the reality is like, yes, I have to tour to a degree, but I would love to do, you know, 60 dates a year instead of 200, you know. So finding balance, that's what I'm looking for.
I think that's what we're all looking for in some kind of way.
Especially as you get older.
Yeah.
You know? It's like you have loved ones and you have kids or pets or whatever. It's like, you know, quality of life.
Well, thanks for doing this today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I know. I feel like we've just been, I just made a new friend.
All right, folks. Thanks so much for listening. That was my conversation with Nikki Bloom. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.